Shrink Wrap Radio number 383, Developments in Neuropsychotherapy, with Dr. Peter Rosso.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Australian psychologist, professor, and author, Dr. Peter Rosso, about his pioneering work in the emerging field of neuropsychotherapy. Peter J. Rosso, Ph.D., is the director of the Medeiros Unit for Neuropsychotherapy, a company that provides training in neurobiology and neuropsychotherapy. He also teaches at the University of Queensland, in the School of Psychology and the School of Social Work and Human Services, and is the director of the Master of Counseling program. Currently, he is involved in full-time teaching and research in the fields of neurobiology and neuropsychotherapy, as well as clinical training for clinicians, psychologists, and general practitioners. Peter's been in private practice for the past 25 years. He holds honors degrees in philosophy and psychology, a master's degree in clinical psychology, and a Ph.D. Peter specializes in neuropsychotherapy and is an expert in anxiety and mood disorders. He's published 5 scientific books and 50 scientific articles. He's been involved in research and extensive clinical trials and presented research papers at 40 international conferences worldwide. He is passionate about teaching and in 2012 was the recipient of the University of Queensland Faculty of Behavioral Sciences prestigious award for excellence in teaching. He provides global leadership in counseling and is invited on a regular basis as a keynote speaker at leading international conferences. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Peter Rosso, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, Dave. Lovely to catch up with you from the other side of the world here in lovely Brisbane, Australia.
Yeah, really. Because of the great distance, we're lucky to get connected. I know we missed each other once because I think our time calculations were off.
Yeah, it's a bit tricky with all the time zones and Eastern Standard Time and Pacific Time to find a mutual time slot that works well. But yeah, it's lovely to catch up with you.
Yeah, and I think the thing that messed us up before, I think I figured out, was that we were on daylight savings time. And I don't know if you have that in Australia.
True. We do have daylight saving time in Sydney, which is a bit south of Brisbane. But for some reason, the Queensland, where I'm situated, does not have daylight saving, which does cause confusion even within the country.
How strange. How strange. Well, you and I are both on the advisory board of the neuropsychotherapist, and we've not had a chance to ever meet in person, but hopefully maybe at some point that will be able to happen. I'm going to base some of my questions, at least, on some of the articles that you've published there, in as much as those were the easiest for me to access of your very extensive writings.
Sure, that'll be fine. And yeah, I look forward to catch up in person at some stage. I have an invite to do some lecturing in Texas next year, so I'll be in the U.S. In April. So we may just make some time to see each other in your neck of the woods.
Okay, that would be good. Although I must say, Texas is quite a ways away from where I am.
But, yeah, but I'm probably on my way to Texas. Need to stop over in California.
Okay, well, I'll look forward to that. So I think a good starting place would be for me to ask you about your view, about your understanding of the term neuropsychotherapy. What is neuropsychotherapy? Is it the same as neuropsychology? You know, what's the difference between psychotherapy and neuropsychotherapy? So that's a whole lot there all at once.
Sure. Dave, that's a very relevant question, because the traditional field of neuropsychology is a well-established field, and traditionally at our unis we focus in neuropsychology a bit more on the injuries that's related to head trauma, brain-related trauma. And as a result, the field of neuropsychology has a very strong emphasis on assessments of brain-related injuries, assessment of cognitive wellness, cognitive impairment, the ability to perform well as a result of some areas of the brain that's been compromised, either developmental or through trauma or through some genetic variations. The field of neuropsychotherapy is a relatively young branch of psychology that focuses on neuroscience. The difference is that neuropsychotherapy seems to focus a bit more on the advances in cognitive neuroscience, especially in neuroimaging. And the question was posed a number of years ago, and it's been more and more one of the research questions for huge numbers of researchers: how do we apply the principles of neuroscience on a day-to-day basis when we work with clients? One of the more popular terms that people use is the word brain-based therapies, which can actually cover, it's an umbrella term for a huge number of therapeutic approaches. So neuropsychotherapy is basically the underpinning of the utilization of the principles of neuroscience on a day-to-day basis for a significant number of clinicians in various fields of mental health work to assist their work to enhance outcomes for clients from a brain-based perspective.
Well, that's very helpful. That is a very useful clarification of terms. Now, some people are going to wonder, you know, how is this not old wine in new bottles? In other words, is neuropsychotherapy being reductionist somehow, or is it rather fostering a more holistic approach?
Sure. That is such a good question. The word neuropsychotherapy can be a bit misleading. People tend to, if you're not acquainted with the term, think about neuropsychotherapy as, okay, we do psychotherapy and all we do is try to understand what happens on a neural level, how neurons talk to each other, what happens with cortical blood flow, what happens with certain changes in neurochemicals, and as if that can explain the essence of who we are, what defines us, and eventually becomes what some people may refer to as a reductionist approach. In fact, the interesting reality is that neuropsychotherapy actually points exactly to the opposite direction. It's understanding how brains interconnect with each other, the neuroscience of neural interconnectedness. We'll can talk about this later in terms of the mirror neuron effect and how mirror neurons connect brains to each other, which imaging studies show quite clearly these days. And from the understanding of how brains interact with each other, it's a much more of an holistic approach, understanding the entire interplay between individuals, and through that interplay, it's not just a language interplay, it's not just a sharing of cognitive information. It's one person listening to the other, and you see the other person's head going up and down, and you realize there's a connection there. And sometimes the person open his or her mouth and go, ah, get it. And you see that light bulb going on. That's that interconnection. And it's through that interconnection that we facilitate a process of neural change, which means when a therapist talks to a client, it's that connection, that real connection, that facilitate the change. And through this, there's some cognitive activation and there's some understanding. But it's this real interplay between individuals in a specific environment. That's, in a nutshell, the essence of neuropsychotherapy.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit more here because, you know, one could say, well, all of that was going on before when we just called it psychotherapy.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. On many levels, what we see these days is what's been around for a long time is now just demonstrated on a neural level as well. The big shift and the benefits of focusing on how this interplays on a neural level is a lot of the work of even, let's go back to the early days of the modern psychotherapy science with people like Freud and Jung and Adler. If we go back to what these people have identified, they have been spot on many of their observations. However, modern neuroscience has established a different portal to understand some of these changes on a neuromolecular level, and it also provides a lot of scientific evidence to what's been around for quite a while. I'll give you one more example. Many years ago, the Brit John Bowlby identified the importance of the attachment relationship, the relationship between the primary carer and an individual, and how that sets the trajectory for either mental wellness or unwellness.
Yes.
Now, with modern neuroscience, we see how attachment facilitates healthy neural proliferation and how a compromised attachment relationship facilitates higher activation of the fear response system through the HPA axis in the brain, the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal system, how someone gets a higher, quicker startle response due to that activation, how someone is just more uncomfortable to engage in new situations. And you see that neural changes that is clearly identified through something that was being hypothesized and being theorized a number of years ago. So it's just a closer link between the more traditional hardcore sciences and what has been around for a while. The other benefit is it's not just a demonstration of this. Neuroscience seems to help us with how do we approach clients. Give you one example. Modern science has demonstrated that the brain develops from the bottom to the top, from the brainstem areas to the smart top parts of the brain, the cortex area. And that development from the bottom to the top means that unless we feel safe, unless we feel comfortable in an environment, our learning is compromised. Now, for therapy, that means unless we have a very solid relationship with the client feel, I can breathe, I feel safe, I can share my secrets, I can share my discomfort, I can share my trauma. That facilitates new neural activation. Mm-hmm. If that's not effectively addressed, clients feel uncomfortable and the therapeutic process is compromised. So it's on those levels that I think science is and neuroscience is helping us tremendously towards new outcomes.
That's a great example. And by the way, feel free to throw in any other clinical examples that come to mind that will help to concretize these concepts to help people understand what we're talking about. Now, I'm impressed that you're so smart about all of this. Because it is so new, and I'm wondering if maybe you had to retool yourself maybe since graduating from graduate school. What's your background and how did you come to be an expert in neuropsychotherapy?
Sure. My background is completed my studies quite a few years ago in South Africa, where we did a combined neuroscience and a clinical master's degree, and after I graduated did a PhD. I worked for a while in Holland where I finished this, and after the PhD I started a private practice and I was also teaching as a professor in clinical psychology in South Africa. And one of my friends in the early 90s was a neuro-oncologist. And one day we were having breakfast, it's part of the private hospital's area. We had a breakfast and he said to me, oh, my new PET scanner is arriving today. And he was very excited about his new latest edition PET scanner. And I said to him, would it be possible for you to do some brain scans for me? I would like to see what happens in the brains of my clients when I do therapy. And he was a bit surprised, and he said, oh, you know, do they have cancer? And I said, no, not as far as I know. But there are mental health issues, and there are some early indications that if we talk to clients, it may just facilitate not just changes in the emotions and behaviors and cognitions, but it actually facilitates changes in the hardware of the brain. And he said, well, let's have a look. And this is how it all started for me. I remember looking at our first PET scanner, and the client was doing some work for us, and he said to me, what are we looking for? And I remember my first comment was, I had no clue, but it's really nice pictures. So this is how things started in the early days, more than 20 years ago. And I said to him, we probably need to look at the limbic areas. That's probably the area that gets more activated where clients get anxious and when the brain activates high levels of distress. And lo and behold, we see how cortical blood flow shift from the frontal systems of the brain when people get anxious and to the deeper centers of the brain. And it's that kind of changes that we realize something is happening in the deep parts of the brain, the so-called limbic system. And the frontal part, that we, let's call it the smart part of the brain, tend to become a little bit pushed to the side. And that compromises clients' ability to think clearly. It compromises their ability to problem solve effectively. And as we all know, it happened to us on a day-to-day basis. Suddenly we're in a hurry. We need to find the car keys. And we go, where's the car keys? And we get really, really anxious. And your partner goes, in front of you? And right. You just don't see it. And the reason for that is the visual cortex, the cognitive processing is compromised due to the anxiety. It's those kind of things that happen in the brain. And once the brain experiences these kinds of distress on a regular basis, it gets hardwired to activate when the slightest hint of a memory trigger that links into distress kicks in. And as a result, the brain wires itself to protect itself, but the ability to proliferate and to thrive is compromised.
Now, you mentioned getting some of your important graduate training in South Africa, and this is blocking on this very important interviewee's name, but the fellow in psych in South Africa who's very noted for his work on neuropsychoanalysis. Do you know who I'm referring to?
There are quite a few, actually, that did some spectacular work in this area.
He owns a winery, if that helps.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. I'm not sure who you're referring to there. Of course, the more well-known South Africans are people like Fritz Perls, that's been around for a number of years and then eventually ended up with the Gestalt Therapy Institute in New York. And
not him.
And
I'm
not sure who is the guy with the winery that you refer to.
I can't not believe that. You can tell me how to fix my ailing brain that keeps forgetting things. Mark Solms is who I was referring to.
Oh, Mark Solms, yes, of course.
I just wondered if he was part of the program that you studied in. I don't know what the age difference would be.
Down in an area that's called the Western Province or the Cape Province, which is probably as far as Texas from California.
Ah, okay. Okay, so let me ask you another question. I'm kind of skipping around a little bit here. Where do you see neuropsychotherapy going? You know, what's the promise of it?
I think the big promise what we see is that neuropsychotherapy provides an additional layer of scientific evidence to a huge number of therapeutic approaches. And what we'll find is approaches right through from the spectrum, from the behavioral sciences to the cognitive sciences to the analytical sciences, and the approaches all have some very significant links to how the brain operates, because at the end of the day, we are all working with the same individual with a neural network. And on that level, we find that, and I found this, certainly found this in the last 4 years with the trainings that I'm doing internationally, most of them in the Asia-Pacific Rim, that clinicians from a huge variety of clinical backgrounds tend to attend my workshops and say, this is the missing link that I was always, I knew it was there, but I didn't have the scientific background to understand why I'm doing what I'm doing. And it does provide that additional layer to clinicians. On a second level, what I also found is a number of clinicians say to me, one of the big benefits is, as soon as they explain to clients, the reason why you're thinking like this, the reason why you have these feelings, the reason why you struggle with certain emotions or struggle with flashbacks due to trauma is also because there are some changes that happens in the brain. And the good news is the brain can rewire itself. So it gives clients a less of a sense of a stigma, less of a sense of I'm doomed for the rest of my life, rather than provide them with a sense of understanding and a sense of hope. And that's, I think, the biggest benefit of neuropsychotherapy is the advances in neuroscience indicate to us we have huge capacity. Just to give you one example, recent research in Japan with clients who were diagnosed with terminally ill cancer consented to have their brains injected with an isotope that colors the tips of the motor cortex. And as they taught these four gentlemen new strategies that they've never done before. One of them never knitted in his life, and they taught him to knit. And a few days later, or within weeks, all four of them passed away, and autopsy showed that there were brand new neurons established in those days before they passed away, which demonstrate the brain's capacity to ongoingly build not only new neurons but also new neural connections and new neural pathways. So the concept of plasticity, it's so powerful to demonstrate that we are not doomed, we are not, to use the Australian word, buggered. we can change, and we have the capacity to do something about the discomfort that we experience.
Yeah, the Japanese study that you just referenced, it sounds like those changes showed up rather quickly.
Yes, yes. Neural connections and the establishment of new neurons can happen within days, but facilitating new neural highways take a bit more time due to it's not just neurons that connect. We need the support cells, the glial cells that support these connections, mm-hmm. and for glial cells to support this and eventually to establish a strong neural highway, that's the challenge. That is the very reason why neuroscience demonstrate to us, if you have a client and you explain to him what went wrong, why we get flashbacks or why we do experience some distress, and the penny drops and the client go, oh, I had a moment, the light bulb has gone on, it does not mean we have changed our behavior, we have changed our feelings. We need a bit more work. Reason for this is to have the initial light bulb moment, yes, is a good start, but sure, we need a bit more work to help the brain to do activate that pattern as a default pattern and not as a incidental pattern.
Now, you may have already covered this, but one of the things you've written about is a new paradigm shift in understanding the brain. So when you say a new paradigm shift, how is the paradigm? What was the old paradigm, I guess, and what's
sure.
the new one?
I'm so glad you asked this. It's actually a fascinating shift that was quite clear and this paradigm shift slowly emerged over the last 130 years. There are actually three paradigms. The oldest paradigm of understanding the brain in modern science was a paradigm that's been identified in the late 1900s by people like Ramon Cajal and Julius Bernstein, Wilhelm Waldeyer. They've identified the brain as a not just a mass of tissue, but actually consists of fibers. And Waldeyer posed this theory that he said, let's call these cells neurons. and hence the birth of the so-called neuron doctrine or the neuron theory. Very soon after this, both Cajal and Julius Bernstein identified that the brain cells actually have an electrical current. And this electrical potential runs from the one end of the neuron to the other end in one direction. And even identified the through measuring, and it's quite fascinating to think that someone can do this in 1902, identify the electrical potential of a brain cell that the resting potential is -60/1000th of a volt, a micron volt. Quite spectacular work. And he identified that for the brain to talk, one cell to talk to another, there has to be some firing process, and it is the change of the membranes due to release of ions, and those ion levels that change shift the electrical impulse from the one end to the other end. So the brain runs on electricity, and that was the first paradigm, is the electrical theory. And as you know, the result of this was that if the brain runs on electricity, someone is unwell, what is the treatment? You zap the brain. So ECTs became the prevailing theory of or therapy for all mental illnesses, especially severe mental illnesses. And that run on the paradigm of the brain as an electrical system. Then in the mid-50s...
Let me just insert here, in case anybody listening doesn't know what ECT refers to, electroconvulsive therapy or electroshock.
Electroshocks, exactly. Yeah. So the theory was, if you can shock the brain, we're not sure what happens, and interesting enough, to this very day, we still don't know. There's lots of research, but we still don't know exactly what happens when we run an electrical current through the brain. As you know, there's been severe side effects, and that's for another discussion another day, where we can discuss how the hippocampus gets compromised as a result of electrical convulsive therapies. But the outcome of this was that most of the severe conditions were treated by initially called bilateral ECTs, which means both sides of the brain get a shock that's released through the brain. Later on, due to the severe side effect profile, people get memory loss and quite disorientated confusion. Initially, in the early days, people even died. They shift to unilateral ECTs, which means only one side. Most of them is actually just the right side of the brain, and there's less memory distortions, etc. And from there, other electrical systems were developed, like transcranial magnetic stimulation or using magnets, etc., etc. That's a different, a long discussion by itself. But that was the initial theory of the brain, is an electrical theory. And then in the 50s, there's always some annoying researcher that come up with something new.
right.
And a young researcher called Henry Dale, and actually an Australian researcher, Dale was American, John Eccles was an Australian researcher, a brilliant researcher who received the Nobel Prize in 64. Those researchers identified a substance called acetylcholine, which is a chemical substance that seems to activate, like jumpstart, the electrical process. So that changed the entire paradigm. And once this has been established, we realize that the brain does not run on electricity per se. It's not wrong, but it's not the complete picture. There's a bit more. And the brain also runs on juices or chemicals. And hence, there was a major shift away from the electrical focus to a neurochemical focus. In general terms, we refer to the initial group as the Sparkies, the group who the electricians who focused on the brain as an electrical system.
I love that.
And the new group is called the cooks, chefs, the people who see the brain as a bowl of soup. The soup doesn't taste nice, so all you need to do is add the right ingredients and the soup will taste better.
Great. I love that. I'll hopefully we'll remember that.
And as a result of this, we see the birth of the brain as a neurochemical process. Some people refer to this as the medical model. That's the model where if someone is unwell, the first line of treatment is a chemical treatment, because there's an imbalance in the brain. And a lot of slightly older clinicians will still say to clients, oh, there's a chemical imbalance in your brain. You need to take some meds. Once you take meds, things will balance out. Then we can do some psychotherapy and things will really get better. That's the medical model. It's a model which focuses on the brain as a chemical system. And in the late 70s, again, there's a young, annoying researcher called Eric Kandel, and you probably heard the name.
Yes, we've been watching him on TV in a wonderful interview series.
Absolutely spectacular work that he did with Aplysia californicus, which is sea slugs. And Eric Kandel basically, well, now I'm jumping to something else. I'll get back to this in a second. But he was the guy who cracked the code for understanding how memory operates on a neuromolecular level, which is absolutely spectacular work. And he received the Nobel Prize in 2000. Now, Eric Kandel always felt a bit uncomfortable with the chemical model of the brain. And he wrote an article in 1998, which is regarded as probably the most prominent article that was published in neuroscience in 100 years.
Wow.
And it still stands as the pivotal moment that changed the paradigm of neuroscience for the next 100 years. This article, it's you can download it off any internet site, any browser. It's a public domain. It's called The New Intellectual Framework for Psychiatry. And it was published in the American Journal of Psychiatry. And in this article, Kandel, K-A-N-D-E-L, Kandel wrote the following. He said, "We are in the midst of a remarkable scientific revolution, a revolution that is about to change the way mental health will be viewed and mental illnesses will be treated for the future," which is quite remarkable for a molecular neuroscientist to make those kind of comments. And later on in the article, he made the following comment. He said, "When a therapist speaks and a patient listens, the action of neural machinery in the therapist's brain is having an effect on the patient's brain." And then he used the example. He said, "Insofar as our words produce changes in the patient's mind," meaning the way we think, feel, behave, "it is likely that our words produce changes in the patient's brain." Now, what he's saying there was talking physically changes the brain. And a lot of his colleagues said to him, "This is academic suicide. You can't say these things if it's not proven yet." And a number of years later, it was clearly demonstrated. And now there's a plethora of research that demonstrate how talking physically changes the brain. But that was the new paradigm shift away from the neurochemical model, the medical model, into a new model. And this is what we refer to these days as the brain as a neural network. It's all about networks. It's not just a bowl of soup. It's not, let's put it in a blunt way, with one example. Depression / anxiety is not a Prozac deficient disorder, meaning it is not about just about a neurochemical. It's not just about adding a specific inhibitor of serotonin, which is the active substance 5-hydroxytryptophan that inhibits the membrane of the serotonin release. And once you do this, depression will disappear. It's about an holistic approach of who this person is in relationship to his or her entire environment and facilitating a new way of thinking, behaving, interacting in his or her environment, shifting the environment from a compromised environment to an enriched environment. And that eventually facilitate a new way of wellness. That's the paradigm shift. So your question it's a bit of a long-winded answer from where things were with the electrical model, which is not incorrect but not complete, to a neurochemical model, which is not incorrect but certainly not complete, to a neural network model. We may have something more in future, but this is where we are at this stage.
Well, I really got so much better an answer than I anticipated from that question. That was a wonderfully rich answer. And one term that you mentioned there was something I had intended to ask you about. You spoke about enriched environments, and I know that's something that you've been studying, is the role of enriched environments to change the brain. So, you know, what has your research in that area been, and what have you found out?
Let's start with the opposite.
Okay.
The opposite around for a very long time. We all know, and this has been general knowledge for a long, long time, when the environment is compromised, we're in trouble.
Yes.
And when things go wrong, when we experience horrible distress, when we experience trauma, the brain changes, and it's been well demonstrated how trauma changes the brain. And there are a few variables that we always consider. The younger we are, that trauma kicks in, the more significant the changes in the brain. The more ongoing trauma occurs, the more the brain changes, and the more significant the intensity of the trauma is, the more significant we see changes in the brain. So age, duration, and intensity are all very important indicators for wellness, but more important in terms of trauma, indicating the severity levels of trauma. So that's the downside. That's compromised environments, or even to the next step up is when safety is totally violated. And those kind of environments change the brain. Take an example of someone going to war in the First or Second World War, or go to Iraq and experience some nasty situations, life-threatening situations. And as a result of this, if it's a one-off, there's a good chance of recovery. If it happens ongoing, the chances of recovery gets compromised. If life is threatened to some extent, that our fear responses is so overwhelming, there can be quite significant, even long-term, even permanent changes in the brain. So that's the compromised environment. So we're very well aware of this, and we've seen this from the First World War, where the first bomb shock idea concept was born, and eventually it led to the identification of a condition that we call post-traumatic stress disorder. It changes the brain. Now now we're going back to Eric Kandel. What he's demonstrated is if you provide this compromised environment to a sea slug, the sea slug's brain change, and it changes permanently. But then he demonstrated if you can provide an enriched environment, now we're getting to the term that you ask about, it can also facilitate changes. An enriched environment, in human terms, are environments where certain conditions are met. We have identified at least four of these conditions, and that's probably a discussion for another day. I can mention them briefly.
Yes.
The basic conditions for mental wellness and for enriched environment is where we have an experience of attachment, a secure attachment, meaning a child that grows up in a safe environment with a relationship with a primary carer, feels safe in his or her environment, can attach with this figure, because that leads to neuroproliferation, and we see that the brain becomes very well in terms of its engagement in the environment. It's interested in learning, it's interested to engage, etc., etc., and as a result, we see huge neuroproliferation. By the way, that's one of my concerns about our education system in the West, which is quite often a fear-based system, and that compromises learning. But and that's for another discussion.
Okay, we can have lots of discussions.
The second very important condition for wellness is the experience of control. We all need basic control, whether it's physical, emotional, behavioral, we need to be safe in our environment, etc. Control is a very important part of our wellness. As soon as our control gets compromised, we're in trouble. And the more basic the control that's compromised, let me give you one example. We fall from a boat, we're in the ocean, and we are not good swimmers. Suddenly our sense of control is severely compromised because we can't breathe effectively. And there's a high chance that we may not survive, and hence not just the fear response, but our entire survival is compromised. However, when the boss walks into the office and say, "I need to see you," and he walks out, that also compromises control, because that fear system of, what is this about? Am I going to get fired? If I get fired, who's going to pay the mortgage? What will happen to my wife and kids? You see how the entire fear response system kicks in when control is compromised.
Sure.
So that's the second important variable for our wellness. The third one is the development of a sense of self, the identity. Having a good sense of self helps us with negotiating obstacles through life. If we don't have that good sense of self, everything becomes very scary. And the third one is the ability to avoid distress and to maximize pleasure. And there are some neurochemical changes like dopamine release and etc. that's very important to enhance wellness. Those are the four conditions that we work with as the core identifiers towards wellness, which is also then important to provide an enriched environment.
Okay, one thing you said that sparked an interesting idea for me was you talked about the importance of the first one, of attachment, and something that I recently was watching, I think, on television or a movie or something, a documentary about PTSD, where there's this incredible bonding that happens between soldiers when they're in that life-threatening situation, such that when they come back to society, they feel bereft. And it almost, right now, the idea that you've given me is that somehow attachment, either they didn't have good attachment to begin with, but somehow now they have a new attachment of a very powerful variety where they become attached to their mates.
That's very true. And the reason for this is there are actually two important variables. In an enriched environment where there's no threat, attachment is also fostered. And we see very good attachment in terms of wellness in life in general. So we can engage, we can do all sorts of things. And just due to the fact that we know we have a good attachment figure, we have family that we catch up with, etc., those kind of variables are important for us. However, when we experience a life-threatening environment or a potentially threatening environment, the intensity of mateship is so much more of a basic survival response that it establishes a new normal for soldiers. And when they've been in that sort of situation for extended periods of time, the new normal becomes the normal. And when they come back, they actually experience a sense of grief and loss. It's as if the quality of what we have here is not nearly as significant as what they had. And we see a lot of soldiers that say, "I don't want to be in this environment. I want to go back.
Yes.
I want to be in any environment when there's combat, because that's where I really feel alive."
Yes.
And where I feel there's a sense of mateship and there's a sense of closeness. The downside is that it may compromise just normal, well, human behavior. For example, having a family, go for a picnic, enjoy being together, enjoy the normal highs of life, and not the highs that comes with extreme risk. That's the stuff that slowly changes the brain.
Yeah, so it raises the question of, you know, how can that be changed? How can the brain be reprogrammed, in a sense?
Absolutely, and that's part of the areas that we work on, is establishing a new sense of a healthy normal for clients, and be able to identify not just the neural patterns, but also the neurochemicals, the endorphin release, the dopamine release when they engage in natural highs. at some stage, I can give you a number of examples in this regard, but that's, again, I suppose, the topic by itself.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to have a new show called the the Peter Rosso Show. I know you're going to have to go in a bit. I wanted to touch base with you on some research that you've done on bullying. Now, that would seem to be in a totally different area, but maybe it's not.
Sorry, I missed the word.
Bullying of kids,
yes.
Getting bullied.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Again, it's bullying behavior, unfortunately, is a very sad reality of life that especially we see with school-age kids. It continues later on in terms of what we use the word for adults, especially in the workplaces, workplace harassment. And how that compromises the brain, what we've seen, especially with younger kids. Again, remember the three criteria that I mentioned earlier. The younger, the more intense, and the more ongoing. Those are the three very important indicators for impact on the brain. So the younger kids' experience of rejection, even violation of their sense of safety, when social systems get compromised, you think you have some mates, and suddenly you get experience some nasty comments on Facebook or social media, and that has severe implications in terms of someone's sense of safety. The control gets compromised, the attachment is compromised, the sense of self is compromised, the sense of pleasure is compromised. And what happens in the brain is, as soon as we experience compromised environments, we go in protection mode. So what happens in neural terms is the deep centers of the brain kick in, the fear response systems, and we go in survival mode. And survival mode is quite often the mode of not engaging, hiding, and that becomes a default neural pattern. So learning gets compromised, social interaction gets compromised, the ability to proliferate gets compromised, and eventually it becomes a mental illness condition because of the severity and the ongoing presentation of symptoms of unwellness. So it really compromises our neural system quite significantly.
Has your research developed any implications for intervention psychotherapeutically with the victims of bullying?
Yes, and again, we use the neuroscience principles of safety, of attachment, as the key guidelines, and that means traditionally what we've seen in some, let's use a school, for example, where a child experienced some bullying. Years ago, the approach was, there was a very harsh intervention to try to discontinue this and discipline the kids who've been involved with this, and it just results in the child who experienced the bullying to feel more afraid, more scared that something bad will happen as a result of the intervention. So one realizes the approach needs to be much more of a gentle approach, where we empower the victim rather than disempower the victim even further, which is the old traditional legal system. Something goes wrong and the police just take over. And as a result of the process, the victim feel even less empowered. So one need to find, in terms of longer-term outcomes, a process where there's a process of empowerment, take it slower, engage, provide information, what do we need to do next, how are we going to address this, and a slower, more engaged process, and also work with the perpetrator so that we can also facilitate some neural changes and effective changes for the perpetrators. Otherwise, we build a society that is either right or wrong, and as a result of this, we don't really provide some effective shifts from what is not correct to more correct behavior. So, the intervention process, I think, has shifted quite dramatically due to the guidelines that we found from a neuroscience perspective.
Okay. Well, I do know that you have to go, and I really trust that maybe we will have the opportunity to have some more conversations down the road. But for now, Dr. Peter Rosso, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much, Dave. It's lovely to talk to you, and lovely to meet you, and good luck with your work.
Wow, that was really quite a tour de force. In a relatively short period of time, Peter was able to cover so much ground and in such detail and depth. Color me impressed. I'd been trying to schedule an interview with him for some time, but it was difficult not only because of the time difference, but also because he's so busy conducting workshops and trainings all around the Pacific Rim. After this interview, I can really understand why he would be in great demand for that sort of thing. Of course, he's also a professor at the University of Queensland, and maybe between his lectures there and the trainings that he gives, perhaps he's either covered this material many times and for that reason has it at such ready command. I'm still impressed, though. I think there were several times when he said we should have another interview to go into more depth. I hope some listeners are out there taking notes and will call out for me the particular topics that he suggested for one or more future interviews. I wasn't able to take notes during our conversation. I particularly like the additional detail that he gave on the work of Eric Kendall. For those living in the United States, perhaps you've had a chance to see the interviews that Charlie Rose has done on the brain during the past year. Those interviews were co-hosted by Dr. Kendall. Not only is he brilliant, but he is also very warm and conversational. My wife finds him downright cute and lovable. I'm not sure where else in the world the Charlie Rose program is available, but actually it occurs to me just now that the interviews are available on the website. So I think if you go to charlierose.com, you'd be able to find them streaming over the internet, and they might even have them in DVD format for sale. Charlie Rose is a wonderful interviewer, and the series of roundtables that he's done on the brain and neuroscience are truly extraordinary. If you are interested in this sort of content that we're discussing today, you definitely want to seek out those Charlie Rose video interviews. I also appreciated Peter's sharing the title and year of that pivotal publication by Kendall, and I intend to track it down. Dr. Peter Rosso is the co-author of the book Brainwise Leadership, Practical Neuroscience to Survive and Thrive at Work. And as always, you can use the Amazon widget on our site should you decide to order it, and a few pennies will fall into our tin cup.
Hello everyone, my name is Mike Hackett and I'm an accredited psychotherapist based in Dublin, Ireland. I'm delighted to mention that I've just become a jumbo contributor to Shrinkwrap Radio. Having really enjoyed the show for over a year now, I've found that Dr. Dave's interviews and his gentle reflections at the end of each has often left me feeling a renewed sense of passion and enthusiasm in my work, a sense of excitement in being part of a wider community of therapists and mental health professionals, and personally enriched by virtue of the themes and ideas presented in the show pertinent to my own development as both a person and a practitioner. I hope my small monthly contribution demonstrates my gratitude to Dr. Dave for his commitment to forging connections in and amongst us all. Should you wish to express your gratitude, I would encourage you to visit the Shrinkwrap Radio website and click the support button to keep Shrinkwrap Radio in our lives for many years to come.
Thank you, Mike Hackett in Ireland. I hope someday to get back there. I have fond memories of my 3 trips there. I hope you'll respond to Mike's example and appeal. Donate today and get your name on the honor roll, which you'll find when you roll over the support tab. And I thank you in advance. Now, in case you're not aware of it, we do have an app for both iOS and Android devices. Just click on the Apps tab on our site for full details. And if you're new to Shrinkwrap Radio, you might not be aware that if you are a professional in need of continuing education units, we have about 99 APA-approved units that you can earn for listening to these interviews and passing a brief true-false quiz on the material, all for less than $10 a unit. I've got a new course on therapeutic relationships that's in the process of getting approved. I'll be sure to let you know as soon as that's available. Let me remind you again of a new feature on our homepage, which is our YOP poll. I think YOP stands for your own programmer. So on the Yap poll, I'll be asking a question from time to time, and you can cast your vote. As I said last time, if you've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for any length of time, you know that I used to play a brief excerpt of the interview at the beginning of the show and then follow with something along the lines of, that was the voice of... Among radio professionals, this is known as a billboard, and I thought it was a cool thing to do when I learned about it. I thought it would give the listener an idea of what to expect and hopefully whet their appetite for more. Well, after doing this for a few years, I got some advice from a terrestrial radio expert who said I was taking too long to get into the actual interviews and that I should not give all the background on the interviewee and basically say, I'll be talking with Dr. X today about Z, and here's the interview. So I started doing that, and then I heard from listener and guest Sarah Hannah Radcliffe, letting me know that she really missed the more detailed biographical background on the guests. So I went back to doing that. Well, now I've heard from listener and friend Oscar in Stockholm that he really misses the billboard preview, that 1 or 2 minute excerpt from the interview to come, and he suggested I put the question to my listener. So I've installed some polling software on the Shrink Wrap Radio site, and I'd really like you to go to shrinkwrapradio.com and find that poll in the sidebar. Scroll way down, and you'll see it in the right-hand sidebar. You'll have to scroll way down, and you'll see it right under the little box ad for Stitcher. It says Yop Poll, Y-O-P. And that poll asks if you want the billboard to come back. Yes, no, or fine, either way. Creating the billboard does mean a little bit more work for me, but I'm fine going back to it if that's the way the vote turns out. So please do take the time to vote so that I'll know your preference in the matter, and please do it soon because I have another pressing question from Oscar that I'd like to put to you. And by the way, there are currently only 5 votes there, hardly enough to give me the guidance I need. So please let me know your will in the matter. Finally, you might be interested to know that the 2014 conference by the International Association for the Study of Dreams happens in Berkeley, California this coming June. You'll find the banner in the sidebar on our site, which will take you to information and registration if you click on it. Now let's hear some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Tony Down Under, who writes, "Hi, David. I'm so grateful for having found your podcast. It's been an invaluable resource of knowledge and inspiration. I'm currently doing an undergrad in counseling, parentheses, in Australia, whilst running a garden maintenance business and raising a family. I listen to your podcasts all day as I crawl on my knees through people's gardens. As a psychotherapist in training, it's wonderful to have a resource such as yours. I cannot say enough good things about your show. Thank you again." And that's from Tony. Thanks for that, Tony. I really get a kick out of the image of you rooting around in people's gardens as you're listening to the show. Thanks also for the promotional audio you sent along, and good progress to you in your undergrad counseling program. Keep plugging away, and you'll be a professional and then a guest on the show before you know it. Next, we hear from longtime listener and supporter, naturopathic Dr. Ralph Wilson, who writes, "Dr. Dave, David, thanks so much for your life work. Your podcasts have enabled thousands of therapists and students, as well as the general public, to have access to experiencing the flow of thoughts and interactions between you and individuals, each of whom have expertise in some aspect of human life experience. This note is to say that I consider myself indebted to pay it forward for all the positive things that have developed in my life after I discovered your podcasts about 5 years ago. I'm now rearranging and adding to the various building blocks of my career so that I'm confident that the mind is a major part of the health support groundwork that people can see underlies the services and networking that I offer. It was especially encouraging to hear you tell about your work being featured on the Armed Forces Radio Network, because I served in the military and would have benefited greatly if your work had been available back then. The women and men in uniform service who dedicate their intelligence as well as their physical safety to the service of the nation each deserve to know about your respectful approach to the science of human mental and relational health. Each person in service and afterward as a veteran is contributing to the overall whole of our society. I am glad that you have a large contingent of supporters in Australia, because it reminds me that the internet makes it possible for anyone in the world to sample your insights and maybe even become hooked on shrink wrap radio, as I have admittedly become. Your wide range of interviews gives us a chance to think about thinking, which is something that never came up as a possibility when I was in the armed forces decades ago. As we look to the upcoming new year, I'm glad for Shrink Wrap Radio because it is giving us many ways to explore our individual contributions to building a healthier society. I'm looking forward to a long future of Shrink Wrap Radio in 2014 and beyond. And that's from Ralph Wood Wilson, N.D. Well, Ralph, what can I say other than thank you for that glowing tribute? Without listeners and contributors such as yourself, it wouldn't be possible. Next, we hear from psychologist Marcel Pratt, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. You may remember me from my request to use your transcripts from time to time in the San Joaquin Valley Psychological Association's newsletters. I have done so several times and enjoy the process of selecting which programs to include. I just listened to Dispelling the Ghosts That Run Our Lives and experienced so many aha moments. I was so thrilled it has already been transcribed, so I can include excerpts from it in the upcoming December newsletter for sure. I was also moved to contribute to your efforts on a monthly basis. I'm a licensed psychologist with a solo practice in the Fresno area. Also, this year, I'm president of the San Joaquin Valley Psychological Association, and we are always looking for psychologists in the Central Valley that would like to become members and be part of our activities. SJVPA is a chapter of the California Psychological Association. Again, thank you so much for your time and energy, as you contribute so much to my life, and I assume many others around the world. With warm regards, Marcel Pratt, PsyD." And finally, here's one more short one from longtime listener Richard Vale, who writes, "Hey Dave, I made it, got through the incredibly brutal coursework, and now I'm a doctoral candidate, my master's completed. Thought you would like to know. I hope you tried getting hold of that Canadian I turned you on to. He's amazing. Regards," and that's from Richard Vale. Well, congratulations, Richard. I believe Richard was at UC San Diego and working on his PhD there in psychology, and it's been a long road. I remember when he was first starting off in that direction, so you deserve to be celebrating, but not too long because you've got to do that doctoral dissertation. And if the Canadian that you're referring to is Dr. Gabor Mate, then yes, I did interview him, and it was an excellent recommendation. And if it was some other Canadian, well, you'll have to tell me who. I probably did, but maybe not. I know there's some good ones out there. So I think that better wrap it up. As always, you can send your emails to shrink at shrinkwrap radio. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on my message phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks again to today's guest, Dr. Peter Rosso, for giving us the skinny on neuropsychotherapy. On the next episode, I'll be speaking with journalist Gabrielle Glasser about her new book titled Her Best Kept Secret, Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.